The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
Welcome to Inside the Edition for Institutional Real Estate Americas. This is Mike Consul with Loretta Klodfelter. And Loretta is going to be talking today about a big feature in the March edition of the magazine. And it has to do with women in the industry. And, you know, before we started recording, I was saying to Loretta that 15 years ago, when I joined this organization, the very first feature story that Loretta was writing, the headline on it was The Pink Ghetto, and it was based on a report written by a woman in the industry and basically decrying the fact that there were not enough women in the real estate industry of stature. And here we are about 15 years later with a new report. And Loretta, I'm sure you remember the Pink Ghetto article, and what I'd like to do by time we get done having you give a summary of this story is do a little comparison between the days of the Pink Ghetto, so-called Pink Ghetto 15 years ago, and today, and whether or not what you have seen is a step forward for women in the real estate industry.
Thank you. And I think, yes, I think we can see a step forward for women in the real estate industry. You know, the Pink Ghetto, named as such, kind of talked about how when women were in the institutional commercial real estate industry, they were relegated to just a certain few opportunities, that most women who are in the industry were perhaps limited to, client-facing or investor relations roles, and that they were not able to pursue the kind of roles on the deal-making side that their male counterparts were able to pursue. And the lack of those sort of deal-making roles meant that, you know, forward progression in their careers was somewhat limited, because the people who, you know, rise to the very top in this industry, as it should be, are those with the, you know, deep experience on the deal-making side. And what we're seeing now, though, and this piece actually kind of definitely talks to a lot of women in a lot of different roles, but there doesn't seem to be the same barriers to women finding a place on the deal-making side, or entrepreneurially founding their own company, heading up their own department, you know, running their own team. What I think is really interesting about this feature that my colleague Andrea Zander put together, and it's going to actually be a very big package connected to Women's History Month, which is the month of March, and it will be in the March issue. And in addition to the feature in the publication, we're also going to have a lot of stories in the newsline, because she did so many interviews. I think she talked to nearly 20 women in the industry, and there just was too much great material to leave on the cutting room floor. And so we're going to have fun seeing, you know, some of these personal profiles as we go through the month of March. But, you know, one of the things that I think comes up for me in reading both the article in the publication and in the other stories is how much things really have changed in the last 15 years. And even 15 years ago, women in the industry were talking about how much things had changed to get to that point. You know, 15 years ago was actually really at a sort of an inflection point for women in the industry. And so, you know, now you look at where we are, and, you know, I don't think we see quite the same barriers to women's success in commercial real estate that perhaps there were in the 1980s, 1990s, which is not to say that women did not succeed in the 80s and 90s, but those who did were perhaps few and far between. You know, now we see a lot of opportunities One of the things that I think is really interesting, and the article actually touches on this, is how much, even in the last few years, the advent of a more flexible work environment, some of that coming from COVID, some of that coming from different technologies, you know, the rise of a smartphone has also been hugely helpful here. But that much more flexible work environment has created a lot more opportunity for parents, many of whom are women, but not exclusively, to be able to be active in their career while also, you know, having a role in their family.
And if you think about this pre-COVID, if a woman had a, you know, family, and it, let's face it, women are usually the primary caregivers when their children are involved. And if they're out of office and working from home, if arrangements had been made, it was seen differently than it is today because the men are home too. So it isn't a sort of a gender thing at all anymore, where in the past, I think it was looked at a little bit there was a little bit of a taboo about it. And when it came promotion time, and you even hear this today, that who is actually there with me in the office when it comes time to decide who should get the promotion? Well, it seems to be a fairly level playing field these days because the men want to work at home just as much as the women do these days, it seems.
Absolutely. I also think there's something a little bit generational happening in a positive way, especially for millennial men who are now the generation who's doing the majority of young child rearing now is the millennial generation. You know, these men don't want to necessarily be parents like their fathers were. So you have a much more engaged group of men on the parenting front as well. And I think that also helps to support women in the working world. You know, when your partner is shouldering a greater share of the parenting burden, it does become a lot easier to be a two career family. You know, and then the other thing about this article that I thought was very interesting, something that kind of jumped out at me, was you know, everyone was asked sort of how did you get into real estate? And the variety of answers was actually quite interesting, you know, and I think I can say this for myself as well. You kind of, a lot of people just sort of fell into it is the way it's phrased. You know, you were working on this, you were working on that, you ended up on a real estate project and you thought, huh, this is really interesting. I kind of want to keep doing this. I'm learning more about this subject. This is very interesting. You know, so you definitely have women in this talking about career paths that, you know, they started perhaps in investment banking or in accounting, or, you know, perhaps in legal firms. And, you know, they kind of started working maybe peripherally around real estate, found it really interesting, and continued to get into and pursue that career. So, you know, I think that's one of the things that's really interesting is how people came into real estate. Other people, you know, had real estate in their blood and came into it that way. So, you know, you do have a lot of different ways to come into the industry, whether it's, you know, parents, a father who was a real estate developer, or just happening to take a class in college and finding it very exciting.
Yeah. And I think that's true for so many professions, that people fall into professions, real estate being no exception. You know, I'm looking at this plethora of women who have been interviewed about their positions in the industry, Loretta, and I see some names that have been around for a long time and then some new names. So what about, for instance, Nancy Lachine has been around for quite a while. How many of the women being interviewed are kind of the institutional memory who are able to talk about past and present versus those who are kind of the, what do we call, I'm trying to think of the event that we hold, which is a springboard. The kind of the springboard people who are new and emerging women in the industry.
And that's no accident. You know, when we put this together, we very much wanted to get a variety of viewpoints from women who had, you know, been in the industry for a long time versus women who were, I mean, I don't think there's anyone in here who's just starting their careers, but are maybe, you know, closer to the middle of their career than they are to the end. And there is a variety of perspectives that are brought from that. And I think there is a difference for people who've been in the industry for a really long time versus, you know, women who are coming in. I think for some of the younger women, you know, we talked about some of the barriers of the pink ghetto. You know, some of these women, some of the younger women, maybe were just barely entering the industry when that article came out. And so, you know, it's a very different world to sort of always be in a place where things are much more open, welcoming. We've got a lot of trends in DEI that have been supporting women in the industry. You know, this is just sort of an anecdote, but at our most recent VIP Americas conference, and as you know, at VIP Americas, we have round tables where people will sit at a table and discuss the different findings. And there's a, you know, whole room, and each table holds about 8 people. And as I walked around the room, I think the very first time noticed that we had at least one table that was all women. Just that was just sort of the randomness of how people had sat out. But there are enough women participating in this industry that you can now have collections, panels, conversations that are entirely made up with women. And it's not even necessarily you know, organized around the idea of, oh, we're going to have a women's event. It just happens to be a group of women, because there really have been a lot more women in the industry now, and a lot more women able to stay in the industry and develop their careers and reach these sort of higher levels than we have seen in the past. And I think that's something
Right.
that's very exciting. And
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
it comes back to, you know, the changing nature of work and flexibility. It is a, you know, and the COVID world of telecommuting and Zoom meetings, it is easier in some ways than, you know, the old days of having to get on a plane and fly around the world, and, you know, everything was dependent on a handshake in person. I think things do get a little easier to succeed in this environment.
You know, I know women who, not necessarily even in real estate, who said they're golfers, and I said, "Really, you're a golfer?" And they said, "Yeah, I learned golf because I'm in business." And you know what? A lot of business is done on the golf course, and it used to be a bunch of guys out there. I'm out there with them, and I'm doing deals with them. So there's strategic ways in which women have infiltrated. But I want to ask you that broader question: how did the advance come about? How did women really start breaking through in real estate? Because as you said, I point out, it wasn't that way originally. Is this just a matter of over time and numbers? Women proved themselves and the promotions came along. Was there anything particularly strategic about it? Did men just come around? I'm sure it's a combination of factors, but did the women talk about anything that was really standout in making it happen?
I think, you know, talking about that, and it's funny that you mentioned golf, because one of the women does in fact mention being told to learn golf, and she says, you know, I learned how to play golf. She says, I can't say my game is that good, but at least I don't embarrass myself, you know. So yes, the advice to the old advice, learn to play golf, it maybe is something that held true at least when people started. She did point out that now, when you go to an industry event, golf isn't the only activity available. And I think,
Yeah,
and
there's pickleball
yeah, well,
now.
wait, hey, and you know, that's a fun time. So, you know, I think there's a lot more of options for people to participate and network. You don't just have to go on the golf course. And, you know, there's nothing inherently about golf that women can't play. So, you know, those are two things to keep in mind. And I think, you know, looking at that and what sort of factors have contributed to this, you know, some of the things that are identified, mentorship, and, you know, a culture of mentorship that has grown up in the industry. You know, I think we have a lot more people talking about mentorship, about coaching, about career development broadly. And you know, and many of these mentors are not necessarily women. You know, a lot of these women say, you know, there was a particular person, this man or woman, who, you know, took an interest in my career, helped me develop, saw, you know, encouraged my growth. I think mentorship is really key. And I think it's partly because when you come into an industry rather young, you need to see what sort of paths are available, and you need to be able to see how you would follow that path to reach some sort of career goal. So I think, you know, one of the things that has been really key for people and helping women in this industry, mentorship is one of those. The other is, you know, a greater emphasis on recruitment. You know, I think that a lot of firms are more mindful about diversity, equity, and inclusion, and are looking at how they can recruit and keep their employees, and what they can do to sort of attract young people, men and women. And then, you know, I think just as the, you know, first women who came into this industry, you know, and some of them are in fact interviewed for this article, you know, as they broke down those barriers, they created space behind them for other women to rise up as well.
You know, I would just add that with mentorship, I've heard women also say beyond mentorship obviously is critical, but then the next step is sponsorship, where a man or woman says, I think so and so is the person for the job. Not only did I mentor this woman, she is right for this job, and I'm you know, throwing down the gauntlet and saying we should hire her for this particular position or promote her into this position. One of the women I talked to 7 years ago, who owns she holds a women's luncheon every year at the IDISA conference and over in the private wealth sector there, and she said that what she had seen was women being mentored, gaining experience, but still not getting the position. And she said that's when the key element that was missing was sponsorship. And there's that to also take into consideration, I would suppose. And then we now see the number of women in college getting degrees outnumbering the number of men getting degrees in college. And I don't think women think in terms of they don't limit themselves. Let me put it that way. It used to be many years ago that women consider certain jobs male jobs, and then there were female jobs. We don't think those that way anymore. I mean, if you look at real estate, yes, it's construction, it's dirt, it's backhoes, and so on, but it's also interior design and artwork and all kinds of different elements that are not necessarily masculine in nature. And regardless of whether they're masculine or not, it doesn't mean that a woman can't be doing that job. So the change has been just marked. What did they say about going forward? I mean, progress has clearly been made. What next?
You know, I think that when it comes to, you know, nurturing the next generation, education and recruitment are going to continue to be sort of key. And I do like what you said about sponsorship. I think that is, you know, taking mentorship to the next level of really being able to like lift someone up, put them in that place, and really say, no, this is the right person for this role. You know, and as I take your point, you know, you mentioned more women than men are getting college degrees right now. I think that the growth of women in the industry might reflect some of just that ongoing trend of more women succeeding in college. And it's, you know, at this point, it's not about how many women come into the industry. It's about how many women stay in the industry and are able to, you know, reach that level of senior partner, company founder. And I think that's something that we're really starting to see the beginnings of, are opportunities for women to be entrepreneurial, to start their own businesses, to run their own companies. You know, that it's no longer being limited to, as we discussed at the beginning, that pink ghetto where, you know, you don't have the same career advancement because you're not on the deal side. And so that's what I think one of the things that we've really seen shift in the last 15 years.
You know, I'm glad you bring up keeping women in the industry, because one of the trends that was going on some years ago was women were achieving some very high stations within companies. I remember that I'm pretty sure it was PepsiCo. They had a woman in line to be the next CEO, and she decided that She wanted to leave the company, and not for another company. She just didn't want to work anymore. And this was happening at some of the big four or six consulting and accounting firms and so on. And the question was being asked, what is it that we're doing? The fact that they want to have children doesn't mean that they have to stop with the career. And they were seeing some great talent walking out the door. And there was a lot of soul searching that went on about what are we doing that is causing us to lose these women who we have in line in the pipeline to take over some of the biggest leadership positions, even the top position in major companies. And I don't know what the ultimate conclusion was on that, but I suspect it did have to do with that the lifestyle, corporate lifestyle, which was inflexible at the time. And if a woman wanted to have a family and wanted to be involved in her children's lives, it made it very difficult to do both because they didn't have the flexibility they have today.
Yes. And again, and I do want to emphasize, this is a problem that is faced by both men and women who are parents, and this new generation, the millennial generation, is, you know, very much the men as well, committed to being the sort of present parent that, you know, perhaps their parents' generation were perhaps not as present. You know, you think of the old Cats in the Cradle song. That is not the kind of parenting that we're seeing. And it does, you know, the world of business trips, you know, 80-hour weeks in the office, it's very hard to see a school play on the road. And so, you know, being able to find that way to balance and find some flexibility, I think is very important.
But at the same time, it does, because of the lifestyle of work these days and the connectedness, you can actually be putting in 60, 80 hours a week and still showing up at your kids' play because you're always on the clock and you're always responsive. And obviously, everybody needs downtime. But at the same time, people are able to really lower the shoulder and get lots done while at the same time not being vacant from their children's lives. So it's a new reality that we're really working in. And I know that this has been frustrating for those who invest in office buildings, as well as just companies in general that want their workforce to be together. But at the same time, it has created this flexibility. I think parents and children are more connected because of it. There's obviously going to be some rough patches along the way. Technology and new models of management have really kind of changed things.
Well, see, yeah, they have. And in ways that I think are really interesting and exciting. And I don't think that all of the changes that are happening in the world of work have been finished. I think we are still in this period of transition. Yes, an investor in the office, traditional office sector might not enjoy hearing this portion of the conversation, but I think when you think of it in a bigger picture of like what is the way to maximize human thriving, then I think this is a very positive story. And you know, one of the things that I think is really powerful about investing in real estate and about the real estate industry is that, and I've this is my soapbox, I've said this before, but you know, so much of what we do as people takes place in real estate. And so, you know, as properties are developed in ways that encourage and support human success, you know, thriving, I think that's all to the good. You know, we want the places that we live, work, and play to be places that support the best versions of ourselves. And I think that's something that real estate can do. And I think it's something very exciting. And I can see why a lot of people, even if you just fall into the industry, you find it fascinating and you don't want to leave.
Yeah. Yeah. And let me get on my soapbox for just a minute, because I've been saying this for 20, 25 years or so, just taking it to a global level. One of the arguments I made is that the competitive advantage of the United States over so many other countries around the world has to do with women being such a big part of the workforce vis-a-vis a lot of other countries that still have sexist models of work and home. And when you're only drawing on 50% of your brain power, I'd say you're at a significant disadvantage, and here in the United States, and you know, like I said, I was saying this 20, 25 years ago, when it was much less prevalent than it is today. You look at women's place in business today and the agency that they've got, it's way beyond it was when I was first saying this. And I think that that's the sort of global competitive advantage of the United States, because we're a more balanced society, more egalitarian society, because we pulled women in, and women have fought their way into the workplace in ways that didn't exist before. It's a big plus for the United States as a global competitor.
I think your point is well taken. You know, any sort of success comes from having everyone participate, and the more people who can participate in the success, the greater that success will be. You know, I think telling a story of community and progress and people, you know, coming together, I think that is just a beautiful story that you're telling there.
So again, the story that we're talking about here, it's the March edition of Institutional Real Estate Americas. I just had it up on my screen and now it has disappeared. What is the headline on that one, Loretta?
The article title is Her Journey. Women of the industry share their early career beginnings with the next generation. And as I said, in addition to the article, we will also see a series of these Q&As appearing in our Institutional Real Estate Newsline throughout the month of March. So watch for that as well.
So kudos to Andrea Zander, editor of Institutional Real Estate Americas, and our editorial director, Loretta Klodfelter, who had her hands all over that piece as she does with everything that we produce. Loretta, congrats to you and Andrea. Thanks, as always, for coming on the program and giving us an update.
Thank you.